78 years ago, Executive Order 9066 paved the way to the profound violation of constitutional rights and resulted in the forced incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans. One of them was Diana Marita Cole. She now lives in Nelson. In 2013, Ms. Cole wrote a memoir about her experiences and those of her family called Sideways: Memories of a Misfit. Her life began in the Minidakota concentration camp in the United States. She has appeared on KCR before, and she's back with us today on account of the fact that she is the keynote speaker at Metro Vancouver's premier social justice documentary film festival, Kwantlen Polytech University's KDOCS, March 12 to 21. Diana, thanks for joining us. How are you doing this morning?
Fine. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, great to have you on the show, and welcome aboard. Diana, the Film Fest's opening night presentation is a documentary entitled And Then They Came for Us. It features actor George Takei, famous for his longtime role in the Star Trek franchise and many other Japanese-Americans who were incarcerated in World War II. You and your family were amongst those tens of thousands who were forcibly removed and imprisoned. You were, in fact, born in a prison camp. Take people back to your family's home in the Hood River Valley in Oregon and share with us a little bit of that part of your life.
Well, my dad was an orchardist in the Hood River Valley, just outside of the town of Hood River. He raised delicious apples and strawberries. My paternal grandfather and grandmother ran a successful tofu ya in Hood River, but my forebears were forbidden to own property. So my father was forced to lease the land he cultivated, and my grandparents were forced to rent the store that they ran. None of them were allowed to apply for citizenship due to racist laws. But settlers of European descent had no problem gaining citizenship or owning property. Hmm. All eight of my older siblings were born in Hood River. And even though my family was poor, no one in my family went hungry because my father, luckily, was able to buy salmon from the indigenous and harvest the food my family raised in their gardens.
Diana, do you have recollections from the moves the family was forced to make to camps in Idaho and then, I believe, Illinois after the war, or were you still too small?
Actually, I was born right towards the end of the war, so I have no recollections of that time. However, the stories of our life in Tule Lake and Minidoka concentration camps were passed down to me by my parents and mm-hmm. siblings. Mm-hmm. I've turned a few of them into storytelling events that have touched my listeners. There are also photographs, of course, of me in Minidoka being held lovingly by people in my family and community. My favorite photograph is one of me and my pet rabbit sitting in front of the tar-papered barrack where we lived. The photo shows how love can shine through even in the darkest times.
They were indeed dark times for you and other members of your family. In fact, your brother-in-law, Art Shibuyama, and his family, they suffered a familiar fate, an even greater geographic upheaval, I guess. They lived in Peru. How and why did they end up in an internment camp way north in the United States?
Well, at that time, FDR needed people to use in prisoner of war exchanges for the white diplomats and businessmen caught in Japan and the Japanese territory.
Right, right.
So the Americans had captured very few Japanese soldiers because they would often commit suicide rather than surrender. So FDR first tried to offer us, the Japanese Americans, to the Japanese since we were conveniently corralled behind barbed wire, but the Japanese government refused that trade because they weren't interested in trading American citizens for American citizens. So FDR went hostage shopping in Latin America, mm-hmm. countries, interestingly, where the Axis powers had already made significant inroads. For instance, the Germans and the Italians control the airline industries there.
Okay, okay.
So he made trade deals and offered loans to 13 Latin American countries so he could take people hostage. And 2,200 Japanese, mainly from Peru, were abducted, along with Germans, Italians, and Jews. And they were brought to New Orleans by boat, surrounded by soldiers with guns and whips, and then interned in Department of Justice camps in the United States, which were different from the war relocation camps that the Japanese Americans were put in. Mm-hmm. And because the the Japanese Latin Americans, well, all the Latin Americans that were taken captive, because their legal papers were seized as they were boarding the ships by the Naturalization and Immigration Service, they became stateless people.
And Diana, if you could tell us a little bit more about your brother. So your brother is in Peru. He ends up in the United States in a Department of Justice internment camp. And then he's later, after the war, drafted by the U.S. Army during the Korean War. What does that say about him in what America did to many foreigners who were put in these internment camps but stayed to become citizens and no less even soldiers?
Well, I wonder how many people know that during the 1960s, many Canadians studying in the States were pressured by the government to fight in Vietnam.
Yes, specifically indigenous folk, actually.
Yeah, right. And so two men I know, Nelson, left their studies and returned to Canada to avoid being drafted. So they were quite hungry for bodies. And back in the 50s, my brother-in-law didn't have any options. So he decided to enter the military in an effort to remain in the States because he was constantly fighting deportation orders because he was not used in a prisoner of war exchange like his grandparents were. So while he was in Germany, his sergeant advised Art to apply for citizenship, which he was denied because he had illegal entry. Yeah.
Wow.
And another irony is that Art, who was designated an illegal alien, was typing up classified documents for the U.S. military while he was stationed in Germany.
Wow.
And his commanding officer told him, Art, don't read the papers you're typing. So after he was discharged, he returned to Chicago, only to find that his sisters and parents had been granted citizenship under a pardon, a process he was denied because he was serving in the military.
Wow, wow. So he kept his chin up the entire time he was alive and just kept on keeping on.
Well, he fought for redress that was equivalent to what the Japanese Americans received, but of course the Japanese Latin Americans were left out of the redress settlement. So then he went to court and filed five lawsuits, and then he sought two legislative remedies. And because all those domestic remedies had been exhausted, he finally went to the International Tribunal in under the OAS.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when he was like, I don't know, 86, he and his daughter went to Washington, D.C. to testify. And then I believe it was 2 years after that, the ruling came out and it was favorable. But unfortunately, he had already passed away, so he never saw the favorable ruling was made. So he fought his entire life against the illegal behavior of the United States government.
If you're just tuning in, we're listening to Nelson, author and lecturer Diane Marie DeCole. She's a Canadian citizen of Japanese-American origin and keynote speaker of upcoming film fest at Kwantlen Polytech University.
Well, Diana, quite a life you have lived. How did you end up here in the Kootenays?
Oh, well, my husband and I have lived in Canada for a long time, over 50 years. But in 2006, he was offered a job as the chief librarian of the Nelson Public Library. So we decided to make the trek across from Cape Breton to Nelson, and have lived here ever since. I think this is the longest place we've lived in Canada. Yeah, so we love the skiing and the hiking and the swimming and the arts community, so it's been a very favorable move.
Yeah, Diana, some of your work is recommended reading and often cited by university-level ethnic and cultural courses around North America. As somebody who has suffered severe racism and seen it firsthand through the lens of American political upheaval, what advice do you have for us as individuals and as a democratic society if we are to avoid a repeat of last century's wrongs?
Well, I think we need to value truth above all things and to hold ourselves, our society, and our institutions accountable for what they do. It's important for us to value the truth tellers, the whistleblowers, and the marginalized. Their insights can lead us to a future of uncompromising virtue, health, and spiritual power.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Diana. We really, really appreciate it, and we look forward to chatting with you again.
Thanks a lot, Diana.
Thank you so much, Darren. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.